you know, kind of a legitimate figure within a political party, that political party is, you know, you got to wonder what these guys are going to look like 50 years from now in the eyes of history, right? They'll look like, you know, the guys like Fritz von Papen, you know, who said we have Hitler backed into a corner so far that he's going to squeal, right? Fritz von Papen was the vice chancellor of Germany, the guy who, you know, made a coalition with Hitler that made him chancellor of Germany, right? These things are processes, you know, and we're very far along a process, one for which, you know, the questions that are asked by conventional political journalism no longer signify anymore.
We're going to continue this discussion and post part two online at democracynow.org. Also talk about what Ron DeSantis represented as he goes back to Florida as governor. Rick Perlstein writes the American Prospect column in the Infernal Triangle. He wrote Nixon Land. He wrote Reagan Land. More later.
Hey, KBOO listeners. KBOO cut through the clouds during our end-of-year campaign thanks to support from listeners like you. When we meet our campaign goals, we can continue to bring you colorful, radiant rays of radio. Thank you, and keep tuning in for unique music, cutting-edge news, and transformative public affairs on the airwaves.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got four requests for this thing already today. Strutting right there.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
This is KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM.
Today is the 51st anniversary of the
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, major U.S. landowners have huge holdings in Oregon.
The DeSantis departure from the U.S. presidential race draws eyes to New Hampshire.
And in international news, a top Saudi official demands Israel agree to formation of a Palestinian state.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 22nd, 2024. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Ken Jones. A Chinese billionaire and a California timber family are among the largest private landowners in the U.S., partly related to their major purchases of Oregon forests. Those findings come from the Land Report, a Dallas-based magazine that lists the top 100 private landowners in the U.S. each year. The newest report was published January 9th. Sierra Pacific Industries' 2021 acquisition of 175,000 acres of forest land and mills made the California-based Emerson family, the company's owners, the largest private landholder in the U.S. The family has 2.4 million acres of forest logged for timber in Oregon, California, and Washington. The report also found that a Chinese billionaire and entrepreneur, Tianqiao Chen, became the second largest foreign owner of U.S. land following a purchase of nearly 200,000 acres about a decade ago. Chen's fortune comes from an online gaming company he founded in 1999 known as Shonda Interactive Entertainment. Chen's stake in Oregon has angered U.S. Representative Lori Chavez de Remer, an Oregon Republican, who's concerned because Chen is a member of the Chinese Communist Party. Chavez de Remer said, quote, "Foreign ownership of United States land by our adversaries is a serious problem that has rightfully sparked unease among farmers, ranchers, and foresters across the country. I'm deeply concerned that a member of the Chinese Communist Party owns tens of thousands of forest land acres, one of our most precious and finite resources, in my district," end quote. Several members of Congress have recently proposed legislation that would limit the purchase of U.S. land by foreigners, especially from China. Chen and his investment company said, via a recent news release Tuesday, that they did not try to hide the purchase of Oregon land. The company said it asked the U.S. Treasury Department's Committee on Foreign Investment to review the purchase before it was made. Non-U.S. citizens own more than 43 million acres of agricultural land in the U.S., or about 3.4% of the nation's total. About half, more than 19 million acres, is classified as forest land. Chinese owners make up less than 1% of foreign-owned acreage in the U.S. Canadians are the largest foreign investors in U.S. agricultural land, holding about one-third of those 43 million acres, much of that forest land in Maine. Chen is 82nd on the Land Report's top 100 list, which includes all landowners, regardless of nationality. His holdings on the list could shrink in the coming year. Chen has been trying for several years to sell about 33,000 acres of the Oregon forest land west of Bend. The asking price is about $95 million.
A 50-unit apartment building in northeast Portland is a, quote, near total loss after it is suspected that a pipe in the fire suppression system burst last Monday. Anchor Northwest Property Group manages the Davina, a four-story apartment building at Northeast Cooch and 20th. A spokesperson for the company told Willamette Week that it may be months before the tenants of the Davina can move back into their apartments. Meanwhile, all residents are being housed at the Jupiter Hotel, while the management company attempts to find them temporary apartments at one of their other properties. Tenants are being allowed access to retrieve salvageable belongings, though the building's elevators are not operational at this time. Pipes in four of Anchor Northwest's other buildings reportedly burst during the recent extreme cold, although the Davina sustained the most damage by far. The management company says the building's pipes were fine during cold weather snaps in past winters and that the fire suppression system was serviced earlier this year.
Donald Trump's effort to win the Republican presidential nomination potentially faces a big challenge tomorrow when New Hampshire holds the first in the nation primary election. Candidate Ron DeSantis ended his 2024 campaign and endorsed Trump over the weekend. Now, the primary is the first one-on-one matchup between Trump and Nikki Haley. Trump dominated in last week's Iowa caucus, but New Hampshire has more moderate voters, and its rules allow unaffiliated voters to participate in party races. Democrats are not allowed to vote in the GOP primary, and Trump-endorsed MAGA candidates have struggled here in recent years. Experts believe DeSantis had effectively surrendered New Hampshire even before dropping out. Now he has former supporters in New Hampshire who have to decide what to do. A Haley victory would usher in a more competitive phase of the primary process. A Trump win, however, could cement the impression his selection as the GOP nominee is inevitable. Haley supporters worry if she cannot beat Trump in New Hampshire, she may not be able to stop him anywhere else, even in her home state of South Carolina. President Joe Biden is not on the Democratic primary ballot, but New Hampshire is hosting its own Democratic primary anyway. Haley does appear competitive, as she has support among moderate voters and independents. She's backed by the popular New Hampshire governor, Chris Sununu. A significant number of New Hampshire Republicans have said they will never support Trump, and without a competitive Democratic primary, left-leaning, unaffiliated voters could also decide to support Haley. Democratic leaders have repeatedly acknowledged they fear Haley much more than Trump in a potential general election matchup against Biden. Haley has campaigned that without Trump's political baggage, she's the better candidate to defeat Biden in November. Concerns include Trump's legal problems, the Capitol insurrection he inspired, and his proven record of alienating suburban voters in multiple elections. Haley needs a large turnout driven by those unaffiliated voters to succeed. The recent Iowa caucuses had one of the state's lowest turnouts in years. New Hampshire Secretary of State David M. Scanlon predicted that 322,000 voters would participate in the Republican primary, which would be a record high.
On the 51st anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade, an investigation by Ms. Magazine explores the advanced planning behind an abortion clinic invasion, one that has been federally prosecuted as a conspiracy for the first time. Suzanne Potter spoke to the investigative reporter behind the project to learn more.
Today is the 51st anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision that established the federal right to abortion, which was overturned in 2022. Now, a Ms. Magazine investigation looks at the case of 9 people convicted in a clinic invasion who are being prosecuted as part of a conspiracy against civil rights. In October 2020, the group forced its way into a clinic in Washington, D.C., harassed patients, and chained themselves together to block entry. Ms. Magazine reporter Amanda Robb says prosecutors established that the clinic violence was coordinated in advance.
A lot of times when there is anti-abortion violence, the perpetrator is portrayed as a lone wolf, crazy actor that just went off the rails about abortion. This is the first time a group has been charged with conspiracy.
Members of the group were convicted last year under the Freedom to Access Clinic Entrances, or FACE Act, but they have not yet been sentenced. The extra conspiracy charge could add 10 years to each person's time. Text messages introduced at trial proved that organizers planned the event well ahead of time and sought out people willing to face arrest. In September, former President Donald Trump said if reelected, he would specifically pardon this group. And Robb says some in Congress want to go even further.
And there is a movement in Congress among far-right lawmakers to repeal the FACE Act that these people were originally charged with and that people who murder abortion providers are charged with federally.
During the Trump administration from 2016 to 2020, the number of reported trespassing incidents at abortion clinics increased from about 250 to more than 1,200. The number of reported obstructions of clinic access rose from 580 to about 2,700, and reported assaults rose from 36 to 54. This story was produced with original reporting from Amanda Robb at Ms. Magazine. For United States News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Conservative activists are closer to forcing a constitutional convention. Maine lawmakers consider a state constitutional amendment on abortion rights. And Ron DeSantis ends his presidential campaign. With those stories and more, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
There are very deliberate efforts to undermine institutions of democracy. So this is not the time to test an unprecedented process to try to make changes.
Jeff Foster with Common Cause Massachusetts says if 6 more state legislatures vote for a constitutional convention, Congress would have to call one, and America's founding laws would be up for grabs. He says a convention would have no limits, especially dangerous right now, and basic protections like the First Amendment might not be safe. Supporters say a convention is necessary to cut federal spending. Meanwhile, Donald Trump continues to say a president should be granted total immunity from criminal prosecution, even for what he calls crossing the line.
And I hope the Supreme Court has the courage to do that, because otherwise you're just not going to be in a very strong position very long. It'll totally change our country, in my opinion. That's how bad it would be.
That's also the former president's legal defense against charges he led an insurrection. And he has separately said he would be a dictator for the first day if returned to office. After a second-place finish in Iowa just ahead of Tuesday's New Hampshire primary, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is suspending his presidential campaign. He's endorsing Trump.
He has my endorsement because we can't go back to the old Republican guard of yesteryear, a repackage formed of warmed-over corporatism that Nikki Haley represents.
Trump's last serious primary opponent, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, is questioning his mental fitness. Trump repeatedly confused Haley with former Speaker Nancy Pelosi on the stump. Haley insists calling attention to that is not insulting him.
But when you're dealing with the pressures of a presidency, we can't have someone else that we question whether they're mentally fit to do this.
According to the New York Times, the Trump campaign barred an NBC reporter from an event because of his coverage. The campaign denies the story, and NBC has not commented. President Joe Biden hasn't put his name on the ballot in New Hampshire, part of his effort for the Democratic Party to hold its first primary in South Carolina. California Congressman Ro Khanna is backing a write-in effort with the aim of beating what looks to be minor opposition.
That's the ultimate form of grassroots democracy.
Some New Hampshire Democrats are instead voting in the Republican Party to oppose Trump. Maine lawmakers may put a constitutional amendment to protect abortion rights before voters. The state already has some of the least restrictive laws in the country, but Dania Bowie with Maine Women's Lobby says the U.S. Supreme Court's historic decision to overturn Roe v. Wade imperiled everything from birth control to reproductive care.
It is more important than ever to make our Constitution as clear as possible about how reproductive rights are fundamental human rights.
Voters in nearly a dozen states will consider constitutional amendments regarding abortion rights this year. Polls suggest it'll be a key issue, especially with women. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Critical law enforcement failures led to the May 2022 school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. That's according to a report released by the U.S. Department of Justice last week. It found that critical failures in the law enforcement response contributed to the tragedy. In the more than 500-page report, the DOJ found problems of, quote, leadership, decision-making, tactics, policy, and training, end quote, led to an overall failed law enforcement response. After a brief attempt to engage the shooter, law enforcement retreated and mistakenly opted to treat the situation as a barricaded subject scenario rather than an active shooter scenario. In an active shooter situation, law enforcement typically engages the shooter as soon as possible in order to minimize the loss of life. Compare that to a barricaded subject situation, where more emphasis is placed on evacuation. In Uvalde, police officers waited more than 70 minutes before re-engaging the shooter after initially arriving just a few minutes after the shooter first entered the building. The report was also critical of how the various levels of law enforcement failed to show urgencies in setting up a, quote, command and control structure in their response. The report also found major problems in how authorities handled the aftermath of the shooting. It pointed to how cops communicated with the public and victims' family members. 19 children and 2 teachers were killed in the attack.
You're listening to the KVU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, rainy, with an overnight low of 43. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy, with a high of 51 degrees. Today in history, in 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court issued its decision in Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton, legalizing elective abortion across the country. The decision was overturned in 2022 in the case Dobbs v. Jackson's Women's Health Organization. The quote of the day is from American science fiction author and Portlander Ursula K. Le Guin, who died on this day in 2018. She said, "Love doesn't just sit there like a stone. It has to be made like bread, remade all the time, made new."
Saudi Arabia's top diplomat said the country will not normalize relations with Israel or contribute to Gaza's reconstruction without a viable plan for the formation of a Palestinian state. Prince Faisal bin Farhan talked to CNN yesterday. At present, a separate Palestinian state remains a complete non-starter for Israel's government. Israel already faces conflict with its top ally, the United States, as well as much of the international community. Before the October 7th Hamas attack on Israel that started the war, the U.S. had been trying to broker an agreement in which Saudi Arabia would normalize relations with Israel. Saudi Arabia wanted U.S. security guarantees to help in establishing a civilian nuclear program and aid in resolving the overall Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had previously said Israel was on the cusp of such a deal. CNN asked directly, "Are you saying unequivocally that if there is not a credible and irreversible path to a Palestinian state, there will not be normalization of relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel?" Prince Faisal replied, quote, "That's the only way we're going to get a benefit, so yes," end quote. Faisal was also asked whether Saudi Arabia would finance reconstruction in Gaza. He acknowledged that was on the table, but only if things changed in the Middle Eastern region. Faisal added, quote, "As long as we're able to find a pathway to a solution, then we can talk about anything. But if we are just resetting to the status quo before October 7 in a way that sets us up for another round of this, as we have seen in the past, we're not interested in that conversation," end quote. The Palestinians seek a state that would include Gaza, the Israeli-occupied West Bank, and annexed East Jerusalem, territories Israel captured during wartime in 1967. Israel views all of Jerusalem as its capital, and the West Bank is a sort of historical and biblical heartland for the Jewish people. It has built multiple settlements across both territories, which are home to hundreds of thousands of Jewish settlers. The last round of peace talks broke down almost 15 years ago. The war has also stoked tensions across the region, with Iran-backed groups in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen attacking Israeli and U.S. targets. Hamas is believed to be holding multiple hostages in tunnels deep underground. Israel has only successfully rescued one hostage. Hamas has said it will only free more captives in exchange for an end to the war and the release of thousands of Palestinian prisoners. Netanyahu has already ruled out such an agreement.
It's Cervical Cancer Awareness Month, and the vaccine against human papillomavirus, or HPV, can significantly reduce the risks of the disease. Current recommendations call for people to get the vaccine in their preteen years. Eric Tegedoff has more.
January is Cervical Cancer Awareness Month, and a vaccine for young people can reduce the risk of developing this disease. Cervical cancer typically occurs in women between the ages of 20 and 50. Dr. Monica Wells is an internal medical physician with Kaiser Permanente in Seattle. She says human papillomavirus, or HPV, is connected to cervical cancer, but a vaccine is available for the disease.
It's vaccine-preventable cancer, which is pretty exciting when we discovered this in medicine and medical history, because a vaccine that can prevent cancer is phenomenal.
While HPV vaccination rates have been rising steadily, a study found rates stalled in 2022 at 76% for 13 to 17-year-olds. The CDC recommends young people get the vaccine at age 11 or 12, although they can get it as early as 9. Wells says this ensures people have the vaccine before they become sexually active.
The goal is to administer vaccine before exposure. And so the HPV virus is predominantly sexually transmitted. It's spread through skin-to-skin contact with someone who is infected.
Wells says there's room for growth around HPV vaccination rates for boys and men who have their own risks from the disease.
Men can transmit HPV to their women partners, so there's that reason. But then men also have their own risks of having the HPV virus, including genital warts, but also anal and oral cancers.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A LaCenter couple had to quickly escape their SUV when they unknowingly drove into a sinkhole in Vancouver early Saturday morning. Catlin Bicknell told KGW that she and her boyfriend were crossing the flooded intersection of West 30th and Washington Streets about 1:15 a.m. when their vehicle's front end took a sudden nosedive. As the SUV filled with water, Bicknell and her boyfriend managed to save themselves by climbing out of the trunk and a side door. Neither Bicknell nor her boyfriend were injured. Vancouver police were called to the scene and report that the sinkhole was caused by a broken water main. The Vancouver Public Works Department repaired both the break and the road later on Saturday.
Montana State University wants to help Native Americans obtain grants. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Montana State University will soon help communities and tribes in six states obtain environmental and energy-related grants. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton explains.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is giving MSU $10 million to set up an Environmental Justice Resource Center. This is one of 10 centers nationwide. The Bozeman Center will serve Colorado, Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Utah, Wyoming, and 28 tribal nations. These centers help local governments, nonprofits, tribes, and other eligible entities apply for grant programs. The program's main intent is to make it easier to apply for funding from the Inflation Reduction Act and Congress's recent infrastructure bill. But the center will provide assistance with any grant process. It's intended to help communities who might otherwise not have the expertise to navigate complicated grant applications. In Columbia Falls, I'm Aaron Bolton.
The HBO series True Detective Night Country features a fictional town in Alaska. While most of the filming was done in Iceland, some scenes were shot around Nome. KNOM's Ava White reports that producers have been in touch with locals to get insights and feedback for the show.
Marjorie Tabone is one of five people on the Inupiaq Advisory Council, which was the team working with the show. She says the producer's goal was to, quote, make the show about a place like Nome. She says the board reviewed the scripts and shared their concerns with writers about scenes and lines that seemed inaccurate or questionable. One of those changes was featured in the first episode.
There is a scene in there where the caribou, in the original script, it was elk. And then we're like, we have no elk in Alaska, let alone up in the Arctic.
She says the council encouraged producers to include Inupiaq words and learn about the meaning behind traditional Alaska Native stories. Tabone says they even helped choose most of the Inupiaq names for characters in the town. The council also encouraged including trigger warnings for the show because some episodes regard the missing and murdered Indigenous people epidemic.
And we advise about leaving traditional parts in and taking other elements of the story out just to maintain the integrity of the story and kind of keeping it true.
Tabone says she was glad to be part of the advisory council and to help ensure the content was as accurate and respectful as possible. She says she hopes it can pave the way for more Indigenous people to work in the film industry. I'm Ava White.
True Detective Night Country follows the investigation of eight men who operate a research station and vanish without a trace. The show stars Jodie Foster and Kaylee Reese. The series is in its fourth season and premiered January 14th. The Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska has filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Army to repatriate the remains of two children from Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania. The tribe made a request in November 2023 for the return of the remains using the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA. The Army denied the request in December, saying NAGPRA could not be applied to carry out repatriation. Last week, the tribe initiated the lawsuit, represented by the Native American Rights Fund. The tribe seeking to enforce NAGPRA to repatriate Samuel Gilbert and Edward Hensley, who were taken from their home more than 100 years ago and never returned. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Monday, January 22nd, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Michelle Coppola, Chris Gao, and Ezra. The producers are Althea Billings and myself, Josh Salem, and our engineer is Laura Miller. Special thanks to Catherine Carley, Suzanne Potter, Eric Tegetoff, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Ken Jones. All of our KABU programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, go to kabu.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
I'm Salima Hamarani, and on today's Making Contact.
I knew going back that I was like, I need to organize this place. That needs to happen. Because even though like I loved working there, but there were always like issues that I was like, this could be dealt with better. And how can we make this happen?
We follow reporter Jules Bradley as we visit a small coffee shop in Brunswick, Maine called Little Dog, where the workers decided to unionize. And we talked to Robert Schlele, a labor researcher and organizer, about what we can learn from the rise of union organizing among young workers in the service sector.
Think about young workers. They're entering an economy that has been, for the last like 30 to 40 years, just been witnessing a race to the bottom in terms of wages, in terms of benefits. So I think that all those things really added up to what we're seeing is what we could call like this huge upsurge in labor organizing among particularly young workers.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Making Contact. I'm Salima Hamrani. And on today's show, we wanted to take a look at the wave of union organizing that's been sweeping the nation in the last few years. And for that, we're starting in Maine, where our reporter, Jules Bradley, visits one of their favorite coffee shops.
There's this coffee shop in downtown Brunswick, Maine. It's called Little Dog. I used to go there every once in a while because there's a violin shop right around the corner. I drive up to Brunswick from Portland to get a fiddle string fixed and sit in Little Dog for a few hours sipping coffee. Little Dog is a classic, cool college town coffee shop. There are these huge windows that let in a ton of light, plenty of plants, local art on the walls, and a ton of students from Bowdoin College right down the road, reading Tolstoy and drinking endless lattes. Something else that's always stood out to me about Little Dog was the staff. They were friendly and welcoming, but in a way that wasn't just cookie-cutter customer service. It just seemed to me that they really cared about Little Dog.
Ooh, am I going to get choked up when I'm talking about this? I love Little Dog because I know people's orders before they like walk in the door. Like I know that person, they graduated college here, they just moved here. I know like so many people's stories.
This is Jess Sarnecki. They started working at Little Dog in 2019, right after they moved to Maine.
I'm best friends with like all the people I work with. My like whole life is at Little Dog, but like in a happy way.
While I could tell that the employees, like Jess, loved Little Dog, there were also all these things that I didn't know. This coffee shop, like many places I've worked before,